Hi, folks, and thanks for turning on The Blender, the new weekly podcast from Radio Free Europe. I'm Grant Padalko, an editor at RFERL.org, and I'll be your host this week. This is episode 5 in a collector series, and we think it's a pretty good one. We sit down with writer Christian Karl, who also happens to be Radio Free Europe's chief Washington editor, to pick his brain about the comparisons being made between what's happening today in Egypt and the Islamic Revolution in Iran in 1979.
There are a lot of differences between then and now, and perhaps the most important one is that that was then, this is now.
In honor of Valentine's Day, we learn that love just might be one of Radio Free Europe's 28 broadcast languages.
It has a complex system of vocabulary to convey various feelings, emotions, especially love, affection, fondness.
And in a new segment we're affectionately calling Meet the Bloggers, we hear from Brian Whitmore, the guy behind our popular Power Vertical blog.
You began to see rumblings in civil society, and you began to see the elite challenged like it wasn't challenged before.
But first, the harrowing story told by our Southwest Asia correspondent, Robert Tate. Robert and a colleague from our Iraqi service, Abdelela Nuaimi, flew to Cairo last week to cover the ongoing political unrest. But before the pair could make their way to Tahrir Square, the epicenter of the protests, they were detained by Egyptian police and handed over to the feared Mukhabarat Intelligence Services. They were handcuffed and blindfolded and ended up sharing cells with protesters who were being beaten and tortured. Robert Tate tells his story to correspondent Ron Sinovitz.
We're here with Robert Tate, and he's just returned from Cairo, where he was detained by police because he was a foreign journalist in the country. Why don't you start by telling us about your experience?
Where to begin? We were stopped by a police checkpoint roughly half an hour after leaving Cairo airport, around about Friday midday. They asked to check our passports. My colleague and I both held British passports, and they then asked to see inside my bag. When they did so, they found a satellite phone, which clearly confirmed the suspicions that we were journalists, and journalists are plainly the eye of the storm, this particular scenario in Egypt, foreign journalists, that is. And they then asked us to follow them in a vehicle they had in front, and we followed them to a nearby police station. That was followed by a wait of perhaps an hour or longer, and before we were taken to another facility, which I guess belonged to the Egyptian intelligence service, the Mukhabarat. And thereafter, we were held incommunicado for roughly 27 hours with blindfolds, handcuffs, and in a cell where other Egyptian detainees were being beaten and tortured with electric, either cattle prods or electrocuting devices, I'm not sure which.
So you were in a cell. Do you have any idea how many people were in that cell with you? And did you have any chance, or did your colleague have any chance to communicate to find out if these were Egyptian journalists, human rights activists, or protesters that had been detained?
I guessed that there were about five other people, or possibly four, in the cell with me. I don't know who they were, because we'd all been told, and I was told in English, no speak, don't speak under any circumstances. They were told the same thing in Arabic. At one point, after a lot of manipulation, the discreet manipulation, I was able to adjust my blindfold so I could see pretty much half of the room. And in my line of vision were three men. At least two of them looked plainly Egyptian to me. The third one could have been a Westerner, could have been, but I had no way of finding out. And the two people I saw closest to me both had beards, and they were doing Islamic prayer at one point. And they looked to me as if they could have been, you know, political Islamists, possibly Muslim Brotherhood.
You've written that you had read accounts, historic accounts of torture in Nazi Germany and Stalin's Russia, in Pinochet's Chile, in Argentina and in Iran. How do you equate the personal experience of that you've gone through to the accounts that you've read in the past?
Well, the first thing that has to be said is I wasn't tortured, so it was much easier for me. It's very hard to rationalize the reality that I have now been in a sort of physical environment that equates to those places that I have read about. When you're undergoing something physically yourself, you don't really intellectualize it at that point. But no, when I read about these things much earlier in my life, I suppose years ago, it just sounded absolutely horrifying. You know, it seemed unimaginable that anyone could be kept in these circumstances and then could then live a normal life thereafter. But no, I've been there, and here I am, and I presume that the rest of my life is expected to be normal.
You said that you weren't tortured, but some may beg to differ that being detained blindfolded and forced to lie on the floor while people immediately next to you were being tortured is a form of mental torture. Did you feel at some point that you may be next? And talk about those feelings.
Well, I had mixed feelings about it. I did wonder if I would be next. I rather assumed, because I know the Middle East and the sort of rather strange rules of the game that apply there, that I wouldn't be next because I'm a Westerner, I hold a British passport and the like, and therefore I was sort of subject to favourable treatment. But you can't rely on that. You don't know the psychological makeup of the people who are in charge of you, who are controlling you, who really have your destiny at their mercy. And, you know, it's a thin line, it's an invisible line. I mean, I wasn't physically tortured in the sense that my sort of co-inmates were, but I was roughly treated. I was pushed up against a wall, shouted at, and it could easily have come my way, and the events I described were taking place a few feet away from where I lay. There was a sound of these click, click, clicking electric rods, which were really just inches away from my face, and you never knew. You just never knew when it was if it was going to come your way. I always felt it wasn't going to come my way, but that didn't make me any less nervous.
Do you think this experience is giving you insight into the Egyptian regime?
It's hard to say if anyone can obtain any insight when they're blindfolded, but it certainly gives me a clue as to why people are out on the streets. It's about dignity. It's about respect. It's about having rights, human rights. And I think these things have triggered this mass revolt against the government of Hosni Mubarak. And I don't think what I underwent, what I witnessed, is peculiar to this particular scenario of the last 2 weeks. I think this has been going on for the past 30 years. This is the way the Egyptian security services, the Mukhabirat, operate. It was obvious it was a well-oiled machine, that these guys were well-practiced and well-rehearsed at what they were doing. And they were simply doing what they always do, writ large.
Omar Suleiman, the vice president of Egypt that was appointed by Mubarak last week, is the man who had headed intelligence agencies and was responsible in his portfolio for the prison system. What are your thoughts about the idea that he is being proposed as a man to handle a democratic transition in a post-Mubarak scenario?
Good luck to those negotiating with him. You know, clearly he is the head of a huge apparatus. He's not, one presumes, personally ordering all these deeds to be carried out, but there'd be no question that he knows about them, that he sanctions them by proxy or tacitly. In my judgment, this is not a man you would want to go to as a first port of call in order to build up a new form of society with democratic institutions, because the institution that I was in clearly is the obverse or the antithesis of democracy, as we understand it.
Let's talk about your feelings coming out of it. Are you having some feelings of black rage, in a way?
Well, I was in the first 24 to 36 hours. Some of that, to be honest, may have been induced by sleep deprivation, because I hadn't slept since Wednesday night, Thursday morning. And so, yes, I mean, when you're in that situation, you're not in control of your own destiny. You're not sleeping. Something has happened to you very suddenly, and it's a huge shock. And then, yes, of course, you get angry. It didn't happen to me immediately. I only began to get angry after a period of time in captivity. And then that increased as I, after I was released from the detention centre, and it was a relative release. We were taken to an internment facility at the airport and kept there for 16 hours, and that's when I got really angry. I realised just the full magnitude of what we'd been subjected to for having done nothing wrong. I mean, we hadn't done anything. We hadn't even spoken to any Egyptians. You know, we hadn't committed any crime by anyone's measurements, not even under Egyptian law. These things would make a person angry. I wouldn't want to go any further than that. I wouldn't say that it's had a permanent mark on me that's going to last the rest of my life, but then who knows?
That was correspondent Ron Sinovitz speaking with Robert Tate.
З вами Радіо Свобода.
Радіо Фарда Кушніка.
Айче Радіо Європа.
Машал Радіо.
Азатить Радіо.
Азатицюн ДТМ.
28 languages, 21 countries, one voice. Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty.
If you're a regular reader of RFERL's website, you've no doubt checked out our blogs. We've got blogs that focus on Central Asia, Pakistan and Afghanistan, Iran, human rights, sustainable development, and social media. One of our most popular blogs is called Power Vertical, and it's written by Brian Whitmore, an editor in our central newsroom, and, thankfully for the blog, a noted Russophile. Producer Pavel Butorin sat down with Brian to find out what he hopes readers get out of reading The Power Vertical.
Hello, Brian.
Hi, Pavel.
And welcome to the Blender. So we're here to talk about your blog, The Power Vertical. First off, where does the name come from?
The Power Vertical is the English translation of the Russian Vertikal Vlast, which is the informal name given to the political system that Vladimir Putin began attempting to establish over the past decade. What it means basically is that it's a top-down system, as the name suggests, a vertical, where all power flows from the Kremlin. In a sense, local authorities are subordinate to regional authorities in turn are subordinate to the Kremlin. This was a significant departure from what existed in before Putin came to power, when you had elected governors and elected mayors.
Okay, and what is your blog trying to achieve?
I mean, it's a blog about Kremlinology broadly defined. The first part of this is what we would call traditional Kremlinology, reading the tea leaves of the high-level machinations of the Russian elite, who's up, who's down, which faction or which clan inside the Kremlin is gaining power and at whose expense. The second part of this, and this is why I say Kremlinology broadly defined, is looking at the social forces and formations and changes that influence the overall political direction of the country and the context in which the Kremlin has to operate. And these two things are symbiotic. They affect each other. And to really understand where Russian politics is going, you need to look at both of them.
And the internet offers a Russian watcher a lot of resources, from well-informed to simply misinformed. And can you talk about some of these possibilities and possibly pitfalls for
a
blogger?
Yeah, no, you hit on it perfectly there, Pavel. It offers a lot of resources. I mean, it's never been easier to follow Russian politics if you're a Russian speaker and if you read Russian. But on the other hand, there's so much material out there, and a lot of it is there's a lot of subterfuge. There's a word in the Russian language called pokazuka, which means using something just for show. And often there'll be articles in the press, and you're reading this, and you're like, is this real, or is this just pokazuka? And I actually did a whole blog post on this very phenomenon of sifting through the Russian media and trying to separate, you know, the stuff that's just for show or the stuff that's been put out there to create a false narrative from the more accurate analytical material that's out there. You have to be looking the other phrase in Russian, kamu vygodno, who benefits. And every time you read something in the Russian media, you say, huh, now who's benefiting from this? And why are they putting this particular narrative out now? That's one of the challenges. Another challenge is getting caught in false narratives or sticking with a narrative that's past its sell-by date. And I'll tell you what I mean by that. You think back to the rise of Putin back in 2000, 2001, up to 2008. The dominant narrative, especially towards the latter part of the decade, was this: the Kremlin rising, the rise of the authoritarian Russian state, the rise of the energy superpower, the focus on the so-called Siloviki clan, the security service veterans surrounding Vladimir Putin. And that's where all politics was. And you looked at Russian politics through the prism of this. Now, towards the latter part of the decade, particularly 2007 and most significantly 2008, 2009, this began to change dramatically. The financial crisis and the, at the time, drop in oil prices damaged the elite's ability to control the situation and the unwritten social contract that existed under Putinism. And that was that the society gave up a measure of freedom in return for rising living standards. But when the elite, the authorities could no longer deliver on the economic side of that, you began to see rumblings in civil society. And you began to see the elite challenged like it wasn't challenged before. I wouldn't say power has left the Siloviki circle, but there's other challengers on the horizon. Technocratic elements in the elite, people who are interested in a more open and pluralistic system have come to the fore. So you saw that narrative change, and the key is to know when to shift into that new narrative. This is more art than science, because it's, if you've been following Russia for long enough, you kind of feel it in your gut.
Well, let's look at some of your latest stories, and your most recent post is Living in Truth, Another Russian Cop Comes Clean. So I understand that your blog is not limited only to Kremlin politics. What is this particular story about?
Well, this, as I said at the outset, I mean, we're looking at Kremlinology broadly defined, and part of that is Kremlin politics. Part of that is social forces and formations. And if you look at stories like this story of Artyom Churakin, this police sergeant from Moscow, he was, according to the official report, the arresting officer of opposition figure Ilya Yashin, who was arrested for participating in an anti-government demonstration on New Year's Eve on December 31st. And Yashin was challenging his detention in court, and an amazing thing happened. Churakin said in court that he wasn't even really present when Yashin was arrested. The report he filed that said that Yashin was resisting arrest and he was pushing and attacking police officers, he said he wrote that because it was dictated to him by his superiors and that it wasn't true. And he said this openly in a court of law. Now, why is this interesting? Well, what lies at the nexus between the elites and society are things like the police, the opposition, and you're seeing rumblings here. You're seeing a police officer basically challenging and saying that he outright lied and that his superiors ordered a false police report in court. So I thought this was one of these interesting things that just illustrates the social forces that are at play in Russia right now. If you read the transcript of what went on, it's pretty remarkable stuff.
It definitely is. And I understand that you also have a Twitter account, also by the name of Power Vertical.
Yes, and I'm proud to say we have, at my last count, 737 followers.
That's good.
So that's, I don't know how that stacks up in the Twitter universe, but it looks good. We're in triple digits, so that looks good to me. For now, I'd like to get it into four digits. So if you anybody wants to start following us, they're more than welcome.
Well, thank you, Brian. You can find the Power Vertical in our blogs section at rferl.org.
Getting back to the dramatic events in Egypt, comparisons are being made between the uprisings being seen today in Cairo and Alexandria and other cities across the country, and the 1979 revolution in Iran, which toppled the U.S.-backed Shah. I invited Christian Carl, Radio Free Europe's chief Washington editor, onto the show to talk about the validity of these comparisons, the status of the Muslim Brotherhood, and about how important Washington's role is in the events on Tahrir Square. Christian, welcome to The Blender.
Nice to be here.
You're writing a book about the tumultuous events of 1979, and you also recently wrote a commentary for the website that looks at some of the parallels, I guess, between what's happening today in Egypt and the Islamic Revolution in Iran in 1979. Is history repeating itself here?
Well, that's a great question, Grant. Of course, history never does repeat itself. There are a lot of fears now that because Egypt has a long history of very, very strong Islamist movements, that something like the Islamist takeover in Iran in 1979 could repeat itself. But there are a lot of differences between then and now, and perhaps the most important one is that that was then, this is now, right? 1979, the idea of an Islamic revolutionary party was still kind of a novelty. Now, actually, we've had about 30 years of experience with the whole range of jihadist groups and Islamic reformist groups and Islamic revolutionaries, Islamic reformers. So we've got a much better idea of what's going on ideologically here, and A lot of that record, especially with the more extreme groups, has not been a particularly heartening one, and I think people in Egypt understand that very well.
Religion doesn't seem to be a big part of what we've been seeing in Cairo and throughout Egypt. That element of the protest doesn't seem to be there.
That's right. The Muslim Brotherhood, which is, of course, the most important and well-organized Islamic party in Egypt, has not been much in evidence at these demonstrations. Now, there are a lot of open questions here, right? We don't know exactly to what extent the Muslim Brotherhood has actually participated in these events. If it has, it certainly wouldn't want to publicize it because that would merely invite more repression from the government and probably make a democratic transition much more difficult. You know, one argument that people have on their side who argue that, you know, the events of 1979 are repeating themselves is that back in 1979 in Iran, the Islamists and the clerics did not say that they wanted – the revolution didn't start with them saying that they wanted to take over power and turn Iran into a theocracy. The revolution started in Iran as a very broad-based thing with a lot of different groups. And some of the skeptics say, oh, well, this is what's happening in Egypt now. The Muslim Brotherhood is keeping its powder dry, and they're just waiting until they can really seize power. But and that may be. There are a lot of open questions here. We just really don't know entirely what's going on. But from the look of it and from everything that we've seen about the Muslim Brotherhood over the past 10 or 15 years, really doesn't quite look like that. Egypt has a very lively opposition movement now. There are a lot of secular groups. There are women participating. The Muslim Brotherhood is also getting involved now, but it just doesn't seem to be that kind of organization that we saw back in Iran in the old days.
Is it more valid to make a comparison between what's happening in Egypt today and perhaps what happened in Iran in 2009?
I think there's a lot of basis for that comparison. What we're seeing in both cases is a lot of young people. Both events, the Green Revolution, so-called Green Revolution in Iran in 2009, and what we're seeing in Egypt now, are very much middle-class events, and they're very much events of the younger generation. You don't see really poor people out there demonstrating. You see well-educated, underemployed people demonstrating, and very often their people have a good knack of how to use these new technological tools, mobile phones and the internet, though that element has perhaps been a bit overplayed in all of this. But yes, I would say there is a lot of comparison there. And of course, the mullahs in Tehran really don't like to see us drawing those comparisons. They want to make a comparison between their revolution 1970 and what's happening in Egypt today. But for the reasons I mentioned, I'm not sure that's entirely apt.
One last question for you, Christian. You're the chief Washington editor for Radio Free Europe, and I want to ask you a little bit about America's role in the current events in Egypt. Does America have a role? How has it been playing out, and how do you see it moving forward?
Well, at the risk of making light of all this, I really, really liked a headline that they came up with over at Foreign Policy magazine, which was an early story they did about the revolution. And they said, "America, you're so vain, you think this revolution is about you." And I thought that was a great headline because, you know, if you watch the coverage from here, you'd think that it's all about us, that they're trying to be like us, that whatever we say is crucial and, you know, our assistance or our support for Mubarak is the determining factor. Well, you know what? I think that America's role in all this is very important, but I really don't think it's the most important thing. And I think we run the risk of making a big mistake if we inflate our own role in all of this. I personally think that the Obama administration has done a pretty good job of balancing the competing needs of diplomacy here. I really don't share this criticism that, you know, we haven't rushed to defend the democratic opposition in Egypt enough. I think there always has to be a balancing in these things. I think you have to be very cautious and very judicious. I really don't think that the first thing you do at a sign of trouble is run in and completely abandon the ally that you've had there for 30 years. I think you do very forcefully push him to make good on his promises of reform, and you certainly try to push him out the door if you can, if you feel that he's just no longer tenable and that that doesn't serve the best interests of the Egyptian people. I think that's pretty much what the Obama administration has been doing. Now we see that Mubarak is just planning to stay, right? And I think that poses an enormous challenge for U.S. policy and for the policy of all the other foreign actors in this whole drama. And I think it will be very interesting to see how it plays out because, you know, the protesters in Tahrir Square, they have a lot of power, but do they really have the power? Do they have the power to determine events? Will they stick this out for as long as it takes? That's the big question. We'll have to see.
Christian Carl in Washington, thank you very much.
My pleasure.
You're listening to The Blender, Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty's new weekly podcast.
When people think about the world's most romantic languages, it's French or Italian that usually spring to mind. But what about Chechen? Aslan Dukayev, the director of our North Caucasus service, argues that his mother tongue is the true language of love.
The Chechen language is a very interesting language grammatically. It's not related to Russian or any European language. It is probably distantly related to Georgian, but even that is debatable. So it has very few relatives, actually. And of course, the closest language to Chechen is Ingush. We can communicate without interpreters, so it's virtually one language. It has a very interesting grammatical structure, at least 25 grammatical cases, a very rich verbal system. We have 8 or 9 past tenses. For example, Sovachar Sig, I went there. You can also say Sovuchvar Sig, I was going there. Sovachan Velletsig, I finished going there. There are so many ways to distinguish these various intricate points. It's very complicated. It poses a great problem for potential learners of the Chechen language, and I can only sympathize with them. I have met people who were learning or trying to learn the Chechen language, but I haven't seen anyone yet who actually was able to master it perfectly. There are very few imprecations in the Chechen language. There are very few swear words in the Chechen language, so it's different from the Russian language, which has a very rich vocabulary in that respect. But the Chechen language is very good in conveying feelings. You can actually talk the Chechen language to a lover or a woman you love or somebody, you know. It has a complex system of vocabulary to convey various feelings, emotions, especially love, affection, fondness, that kind of stuff. When I was younger, I noticed that it's easier for me to explain things that which I wanted to tell a woman or a girl in the Chechen language than in Russian. It's so much better for that kind of purpose. I think we can safely say that more than 1 million people can speak Chechen. The surveys indicate the vast majority of Chechens speak their native language. One I saw was about 98% of all Chechens speak the Chechen language fluently. But we've also been noticing that increasingly the Chechen language is spoken less and less by people who move from Chechnya elsewhere. So it's a big problem now. I'm afraid Chechen will be less and less popular among Chechen people.
That was Aslan Dukayev, the director of our North Caucasus service. And that's all we have for this week. You know, we'd love to hear your thoughts about this podcast. Send an email to podcast@rferl.org. And we hope you'll be coming back again next week for another edition of The Blender, featuring the best of Radio Free Europe.
For uncensored news and music, millions of East Europeans switch on Radio Free Europe, the in sound from outside.
And don't forget to check us out on the interweb at rferl.org. Until next time, this is Grant Padalko. Thanks for turning on The Blender. I think I caught my stone.